Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club and chair of tonight's program. Tonight's event is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's my pleasure to introduce a very special guest this evening, my favorite living novelist, T.C. Boyle. Dr. Boyle is Distinguished Professor of English at the University of Southern California and author of 22 novels and collections of short stories. He is a thought-provoking writer who has explored the lives of complex American characters, including Alfred Kinsey in The Inner Circle, Frank Lloyd Wright in The Women, John Harvey Kellogg in The Road to Wellville, and Stanley and Catherine McCormick in Riven Rock. In other works, Boyle explores clashes of values and cultures. In Talk Talk, the interaction between an identity thief and his victim. In The Tortilla Curtain, the collision between residents of L.A.'s privileged hillside developments and the illegal immigrants living side by side with them camping in the canyons nearby. And in his newest and very striking work, When the Killing's Done, Boyle portrays the conflict between zealots with very different approaches to protecting the flora and fauna of California's Channel Islands. A graduate of SUNY Potsdam in upstate New York, T.C. Boyle received a Master of Fine Arts from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop, as well as a Ph.D. in 19th century British literature from the University of Iowa. He has won many of the most prestigious awards for writing, including a Penn Faulkner Award, I believe 4 O. Henry Awards, and 3 medals, 2 silver and 1 gold, from the Commonwealth Club's own California Book Awards. He is also a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. His short story, Sorry Fuju, is currently being performed by the Word for Word Theater Company here in San Francisco. T.C. Boyle lives with his wife and 3 children in the first home designed in California by Frank Lloyd Wright near Santa Barbara. Please join me in welcoming T.C. Boyle to the Commonwealth Club.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome. What fun it is to be back here again. And this is the very beginning of a paperback tour for When the Killing's Done. And all I had to do was fly up from Santa Barbara tonight and fly back tomorrow. No big deal, right? But for the airlines. Oh, those prevaricators. Everything is torture, even the simplest flight. But I won't. Why complain? Why complain? Because, you know, statistically now, you know, if you realize this, the on-time arrival rate is rocketing. It's really great. It used to be 10 in every 12 million planes was on time. Now it's 13 out of every 12 million flights is on time. And, you know, if you don't like it, walk to Cleveland, you know? I mean, that's your alternative. So, enough of that. As I say, I've got a new paperback out of When the Killing's Done. I was here in town last February and did many events regarding that. I know that most of you didn't hear them, and they were beautiful, and I'm sure they would have moved you if you'd been there. But tonight, I thought that I would instead present you with a brand new short story. What I'm working on now is a new volume of stories to be folded in with the previous 3 so that, not this fall, because this fall I have a new novel, but the following fall will be T.C. Boyle Stories 2, the collected volume 2 of the stories. And the first of them I would like to present to you tonight. I've never read it to anybody except my wife and my dog, and you're going to get it tonight. And I felt that if we want to talk about some of the ecological concerns of When the Killing's Done and what went on the Channel Islands, 26 miles from my window, maybe we'll address that when Gloria and I chat afterwards and we take your questions. Okay, for now, though, I want to give you a story. This is what I love to do, and the time has come. For those of you listening to this at home, all you have to do is close your eyes and sit back. For those of you present, though, you have to suspend disbelief in this way. I'm going to narrate the story in the first person. I have to become this person in the story. So to do that, you have to now envision me as 7 inches taller and 260 pounds heavier. You ready for that? The story was in the New Yorker last month. It's called Los Gigantes. At first, they kept us in cages like zoo animals, but that was too depressing. After a while, we began to lose interest in what we'd been brought there to do. We didn't think about it, or not much anyway. We were just depressed, that was all. And when they brought the women to us, it was inevitable that we went about the business in a half-hearted way. In any case, it was soon over, and then it was time for a meal, another meal. They fed us well, I'll say that for them. No expense was spared. And the food was good, the best I'd ever tasted, prepared for us by a man who was rumored to have been the first assistant to the pastry chef at the presidential palace before he was replaced by a Frenchman who didn't speak a word of Spanish. Originally, we were 10, but one of our number was suspect and soon rooted out. It happened that a woman refused to go with him. And when Corporal Carrera, who held the keys, wanted to know why, she said, "Just look at him." And he did. We all did. This was during the first week, by the way, when we really hadn't had a chance to get to know one another yet, and no one had given the man much thought. Why would we? We were being fed. We had women. Life was good. Anyway, once this woman had spoken up, we all began to scrutinize him and saw what she meant. He was damaged goods. He was tall enough, 3 or 4 inches taller than me, in fact, and thick in the limbs, but his face was like an anvil, and his eyes couldn't seem to focus. And when he talked, it was in disconnected monosyllables that seemed to dredge themselves up out of some deep fissure in his digestive tract. The man in the cage beside mine whispered, "Pituitary freak." And in the instant, I saw what I'd missed. Yes, damaged goods. No sense in wasting the stipend, the ex-assistant pastry chef's culinary concoctions, and all those prescribed women on him. I felt a sense of outrage. There was as much about my own humiliation as anything else. Whoever had chosen him had chosen me, too. And what did that say about me? Even worse, for the first time in my life, I had to contend with the fact that I wasn't the biggest man around. At 6 feet 10 inches and 420-odd pounds, I wasn't far off. But there were two men heavier in addition to the pituitary case. Freak or not, he'd still look down at me. All my life, I'd been the one looking down on the world, the biggest boy and then the biggest man, not only in my own bustling port city, but in the entire province. I was strong, too. At the Fiesta de Primavera, I once lifted 2 sheep above my head, 1 in each hand. And for a prank, when I was in my teens, I hauled the mayor's shining black Duesenberg coupe up the steps of the Ministry of Justice and left it there at the gilded statue of the president. By the time I turned 20, I was earning a good wage cranking the capstan that lifted the wooden drawbridge in the center of town so that the high-masted fishing vessels could pass beneath it. And if that seems unremarkable, just consider that formerly 3 mules had been required to do the job, mules that were now free to pull plows through the fields of maize that ring the city, while the mule skinner himself was able to retire on a small pension and move into the house his mother had left him at the place where the river runs brown into the moss green sea. People would come out to watch me work. Families with picnic baskets, nubile women, strong men, grandmothers, sailors. My legend grew. Of course, to be a legend, to attain that status is to court attention. That was how they find me. And truly, I wish they never had. Within the month, the first rumors of discontent began to circulate amongst us. If in the beginning it had seemed as if we'd arrived in paradise, our days given over to leisure, and nothing expected of us but the essentials, the routine began to wear on us. We were free to roam the compound by day, and we had books and a radio, and we played games of cards and dice. The usual sort of thing. But we were locked in at night. And the cages, though they were roomy enough, and each equipped with a toilet, desk, couch, and reading lamp, in addition to a gargantuan steel-frame bed, were an oppression of the spirit. The man I was to become closest to, Fruto Lacayo, a former circus fat man who stood 7 inches shorter but outweighed me by some 40 pounds, was the first to voice his complaints. We were in the courtyard one afternoon, smoking, chatting, getting our bearings in this place that was not, despite appearances, a former zoo, but in fact a camp where the regime had kept dissidents in a time before dissidents became so radically discouraged as to eliminate it altogether. Fruto had been pacing along the path that traced the outer walls under the beneficent gaze of the guard in the tower, who wasn't a guard at all, we were told, but rather a facilitator. When he came directly across the courtyard to where I was sitting in the shade with the latest issue of Hombre, examining the photographs of the slim, ankled women who stared out from its pages with looks of airbrushed longing. "Jesus Christ," he muttered, gasping for breath. "I feel like my joint's about to fall off." I gave him a wary smile. He was a fat man. I was a giant. And if you don't see the distinction, then you have no access to my soul and no appreciation either. I shrugged. Better than working, isn't it? There was a sheen of sweat on his jowls. It was winter then, thank the Lord and the Blessed Virgin, but still the humidity was high, and the afternoon temperatures were in the 80s and even 90s, so that we were always uncomfortable, especially where our parts chafed. "I'm not so sure," he said. "It's these cages. We're not animals." "No," I said, "we're not." "Do you know what the president did before he joined the army? Professionally, I mean?" I didn't. He'd been president before I was born, and I expected he'd be president still when I moved on to the next world. Fruto winked, as if he were letting me in on a great secret. "You don't? You really don't?" I shook my head. "Well, let me tell you. Let me awaken you. He was a cattle breeder." The initial breakout wasn't a serious attempt. It was perfunctory at best. But at least it made a statement. At least it was a beginning. Early one night, after we'd lain with the evening's women and were gathered around the radio in the courtyard, half listening to the tail end of one of the president's speeches, rumba music, that was what we wanted, and Rumba Ciudad was due to come on at 8. Fruto heaved himself up from his chair and, addressing us all, growled, "I don't know about you, but I've had it. I'm going home tonight, soon as it's dark." There was a flutter of astonished voices. "You can't be serious. Have you gone mad? Leave here?" Melchior Arce, a former stevedore, who was nearly as wide across the shoulders as me, though his head was disproportionately small and his left hand had been mangled in an accident so that it looked like a crushed tarantula dangling from his shirt sleeve, gave a whistle of surprise. "The only way they'll get me out of here," he said, "is in a coffin." He paused to bite off the end of his cigar and spit it in the dirt. "What's wrong with you, fat man? You a maricón?" "You want to know the truth?" Frutos went on, ignoring the insult. "I don't like big women. Never have. I like them petite, the way women should be. If I want to see fat, I can just look in the mirror." If I'd been feeling the stirrings of my own discontent, now I went rigid with longing. All I could see was the face of Rosa, my Rosita, the girl I'd left behind when I'd signed the agreement and come all the way across the country to be cooped up here in this stifling compound with its jungle reek and chicken wire cages that showed us for what we really were. Rosa was petite by any measure, 100 pounds, if that, and an inch short of 5 feet. I, too, had always been attracted to the sleek and unencumbered, to the girls who looked more like children than women. And why was that? Because opposites attract. Of course they do. Otherwise, we'd all be pygmies or giants instead of something proportional, something in between. I'd asked her to wait for me. "I'll be gone 6 months," I told her, "a year at most. And we'll save the stipend, every penny of it, so we can be married when I come back." She asked what the government wanted of me, pressed me over and over, but I couldn't tell her. "Secret work," I'd said. And she'd looked up at me out of her saucer eyes, beseeching, wanting more, the truth. "Top secret," I said, "for the military." But now, as soon as Fruto spoke the words, I knew I was going with him. We gathered a few things, sliced meat, bread, chocolate bars left over from dinner, and waited till lights out at 10, when the nocturnal clamor of the jungle rose to crescendo, and our fellow gigantes, exhausted from their venereal labors, turned over in their massive beds and began to snore. Then we made our way across the courtyard to the main gate, which was secured by a padlocked chain doubled over on itself. The guard was asleep. Nothing moved but for a solitary rat silhouetted against the faint glow of the village that lay 3 miles to the west of us. I took hold of the chain in the grip of my two hands and snapped it without even trying. It was nothing, a child's toy, a poor, weak thing designed to forestall ordinary men. And then I rolled back the gate on its lubricated rail, and in the next moment we were outside in the darkness. The problem was Fruto. We hadn't gone 500 yards down the dirt lane that would take us to the village, where there were taxis, buses, even a rail line that would give us access to the whole of the country, to freedom, to the slim and beautiful, to Rosita, when he sat ponderously on a wet stump overgrown with black twisted vines and, wheezing heavily, croaked, "I can't go on." "Can't go on? What are you talking about? We just left the place." I crushed mosquitoes against the back of my neck. Something flapped across the darkened road. "Give me a minute. Let me catch my breath." I could barely make out the shape of him there in the dense clot of shadows. I heard him slapping at his own host of mosquitoes. "You don't have one of those sandwiches handy, do you?" he asked. "Look," I said, "if we expect to get out of this, to go home, you do want to go home, don't you? We'll need to get to the village and purchase a bus ticket or hire a taxi and be gone before they bring the morning's women." "Go on without me," he said. The air seemed to tear through his lungs. "I'll follow you after I've had a bit of rest and a sandwich. Let's split up the provisions now, just in case." "In case of what?" "In case we don't meet up again." So I left him there. It was no less than he deserved. The worst that would happen was that they would take him back to his cage, to food and leisure and the manipulation of the flesh. For my part, I made it as far as the village, where I found myself distracted by the lights of a cantina. I had to duck to get through the door. Everyone stared. I should say, in my own defense, that I'm not one of these men who drink themselves senseless, but they didn't allow us any liquor in the compound, for fear it would affect our performance, I suppose. And the taste of it, after more than a month without, made me want another taste, and another after that. I slept somewhere, I don't remember where. And in the morning, when they came for me, I went along with them as docilely as one of the sheep I'd lifted above my head, as if they were no more than woolly clouds trailing across a serene blue sky. The following afternoon, after we'd eaten our lunch and ministered to the women who joined us each day at siesta time, Fruto and I were summoned to the military barracks on the far side of the village. A truck, painted in camouflage colors, took us through town, ordinary women, ordinary men, bicyclists, street vendors, dogs that were so ordinary even the bitches that whelped them wouldn't have given them a second glance, and into another compound, this one made of whitewashed brick with a three-story building at the center of it. Corporal Carrera led us up the stairs and into a grand office on the second floor that was presided over by a monumental oil portrait of the president and a dozen limp flags representing each of the country's provinces. There was a bank of windows spilling light. Beneath them stood a mahogany desk, very grand in size, though to us it was like the sort of thing children make use of in elementary school, and seated at the desk, in full military uniform replete with epaulets and layered decorations, was a man we recognized as Colonel Lazaro Apunto, Director of Educational and Agricultural Resources for the Western Region. There were no seats for us, or no seats large enough, and so we were made to stand. A long moment elapsed. Corporal Carrera stationed at the door, the colonel gazing up at us with a look caught halfway between irascibility and awe. Finally, he spoke. "So, I'm given to understand that you two have been abrogating your patriotic duties. Is that correct?" I said, "Yes, that is correct." "You have complaints, legitimate complaints?" This started Fruto going in the way that a molded steel crank in the hands of the president's chauffeur might fire up a bulky engine. "We are not animals," he said, "and we want our privacy. We can't be expected to be intimate in a chicken wire cage where anyone can see for himself how we go about our business, and the heat is intolerable, and the insects, and..." "And the food?" the colonel asked, cutting him off. "Is that not of the highest order, rich in protein, flavorful? And your stipends, the money we send on each week to your families, your loved ones, whose addresses we scrupulously maintain, aren't they sufficient? And what of work? It's not as if we're asking you to work." "The food is excellent," I said, stifling the impulse to append "Your Excellency" to the assessment. "Good," the colonel said, leaning back in his chair. "Very good." He was a little man, with mustaches. But then they were all little men. Everyone in the military, everyone on the street, even the president himself. "For a moment there, I thought you were going to renege on your contract with the government. But here I see the whole matter is nothing, really, just a question of adjustments. You want stucco walls built over the chicken wire? Fine, it will not be a problem. In fact," he scrawled something on a pad, "we'll see to it immediately." "Tile floors," Fruto put in, "for the sake of the coolness on our feet. A fan, two fans, and a radio in each room, and a day off, once a week, Sundays off." He bowed his head, mopped sweat. His grin was like a grimace. "The day of rest, eh? Our Lord's Day." The colonel tented his fingers, smiled benignly at us. He waved a hand. All this can be arranged. Your needs are our needs. If you haven't already divined the importance of the project in which you're participating, let me enlighten you. The president, the country, has many enemies. I don't have to tell you that. They are building up their armed forces, constantly building and accelerating. And who can guess what their purposes are? But we must counter them. Do you know your Greeks? Greeks? I echoed, mystified. Homer, Aeschylus, Euripides. They had their heroes, their champions, their Achilleses and Ajaxes. And that is what the president envisions for our country's forces. And not simply individual heroes, but an entire regiment of them. Do you see? Like Samson, Fruto put in. The colonel shot him a look. Not the Hebrews, the Greeks. They knew how to win a war. The president must be a very patient man, I offered. It'll take generations. A shrug. Prescient is the word. That is why he is the father of our country. And don't concern yourself. We will breed the issue of your labors, the females that is, once they reach puberty. And when that issue reaches puberty, we will breed them as well. He fumbled for something on his desk, sifting through the papers there until he held up a single sheet, transparent in the light glazing the windows. Do you see this? This is a sample requisition form to be sent out to the bootmakers of the future, calling for boots in exactly your size, senor. 18 triple E. Just think of it. He settled back in his chair. Helmets the size of bird baths. Jerseys like tents. No, my friends. The president is a man of foresight. A futurist, you might say. And his vision is all-encompassing. Are you not proud of your country? Do you not want, with all your heart, to protect and nourish her? Fruto stood there, dazed. I nodded in assent, but it was only for show. Was I seething inside? Not just then, perhaps. We'd already had a pretty fair idea of what was wanted from us, and we had, after all, signed on the dotted line as venal as any other men. But I could see the months to come, years even, stretching out before me like a sentence in the penitentiary. Copa Carrera pulled open the door behind us, our signal to vacate the room. Our business was concluded. But just as we reached the door, my legs working autonomously, and Fruto heaving for breath and wiping at his massive face with the great sopping field of his handkerchief, the colonel called out to us. Now go and do your duty, for the love of your country and of the president. Go to your female volunteers, whose stipends are but half of yours, incidentally, and so it should be, and in your throes, think of him. The colonel was as good as his word. Improvements came rapidly, laborers from the village appearing the very next day to reinforce the frames of the cages with 4x4 posts, enclose them in walls of lath and stucco and lay tile in a handsome herringbone pattern you could stare at for hours. There were tin roofs. Each of us got a radio. At night, electric fans stirred the breezes and mosquito netting held the insects at bay. I'd volunteered to help with the work. Let's face it, I was bored to the point of acuity with all that sitting around, but the colonel wouldn't hear of it. No, he said, on one of his inspections of the compound. You must conserve your energy. And here the hint of a smile appeared beneath the dark cantilever of his mustaches. For your president and your country. In the interim, we were bused to the women's compound, which, as it turned out, lay some 3 miles to the north of the men's facility, on the banks of a nameless, oozing watercourse that bred mosquitoes and stinging flies and the pestilent millions, so that we were all of us, men and women alike, scratching furiously the entire time we were there. What distinguished their compound from ours, aside from the increase of insects? Not much. They, too, lived in cages, but they were crammed in, 4 or 5 of them to a cage, and their camp stretched as far as the eye could see. If we were 9, the women numbered in the hundreds, and this, of course, reflected a simple calculus any cattle breeder could have worked out on a single sheet of paper. The women I was put in with the first night were among the biggest in the camp, selected especially for me. And by big, I don't necessarily mean the heaviest. Such women were reserved for Fruto and his ilk, but the tallest and broadest, with the longest limbs and thickest bones. These women could have felled forests, collapsed mines, held back the sea just by linking arms. Where the president had found them, I couldn't imagine. Not till one of them called me by name. I'd just set down my overnight bag and taken possession of the bed, as uninterested in these women as I'd been in the phalanxes that had trooped in and out of my cage at the men's compound, when one of them broke ranks and came across the dirt floor to me, my name on her lips. She was Magdalena Duarte. She'd been raised in the city I called home and, in a shy voice, told me that she'd often come to the drawbridge to watch me at work when she was just a girl. Before my growth spurt, she said, covering her mouth with one hand as she laughed at her own joke. Later, after we'd coupled by rote while the insects whined and the other women, utterly indifferent, unfurled straw mats and lay down to sleep, she asked me how I was adjusting to my new role in life. Did I like it? Anything for the president, I said. Her voice was soft with a scratch in it. All work and no play, eh? Something like that. But what of you? Do you like serving your country? I could just make out her features in the light of the guard tower where it fell across the wire mesh of the cage. She glowed a moment, her face like a moon rising over a dim horizon. They move us to a nicer place once we're pregnant, she said. And the stipend is all my parents have to live on in these times. You see, I come from a large family, she caught herself, giggled softly. Of many children, that is, 13 of us. And so when the recruiter came to us, I did my duty. To the president, yes, and to my family as well. I was quiet a moment, thinking about that duty, when she dropped her voice even lower and whispered, you know, there's another compound, two other compounds. No, I said. I had no idea. Beside us, in the dark, the giantesses heaved and blew and let their stertorous snores crash through their dreams. For little people. Little? What do you mean, little? Forgive me, in that moment, if I thought of Rosa, my Rosita, and her perfect diminutive feet that were the size of a child's, of her mouth, her lips, the way she would tease me good-naturedly every time I had to bend double and squeeze sideways through a doorway or avoid the chairs in her parents' parlor for fear of splintering them. Not dwarves, not midgets. The president wants normal stock only, but people who, by the grace or whim of God, are very fine and very small. She left the thought hanging there. The darkness seizing me, the mosquitoes raging till the furious cacophony of their wings drove down every sound in that place. But why? Why would he want little people? I couldn't see anything but her face in the mosaic shadow of the wire, but I could feel her shrug animate the mattress. They say he wants to create a race no more than 2 feet high and normal in every other way, intelligent, active, people like cats who can come and go in the night without detection. Spies? Another shift of the mattress. She was nodding now. Our fatherland has many enemies, she said, whispering still, as if fearful of being overheard. We must be ready for them. I couldn't sleep that night, not a wink, not after what Magdalena had told me. I kept picturing Rosa in a camp like this one, stepping into a cage where a wiry little man like a human chihuahua lay waiting for her, though I knew it was absurd. Rosa was an innocent. She would never volunteer, never allow herself to be conscripted, no matter what pressures were brought to bear. Or would she? Would she feel moved in her heart, in her loins, to serve her country like all these patriotic women laid out snoring in the darkness before me? The thought seared me, burned in my brain like the perpetual flame illuminating the grave of our president's lamented mother. It was dawn by the time I finally dozed off, my dreams poisoned and my heart constricted as if a noose had been drawn tight around it. After that, I bided my time. And when they moved us back into our new apartments in the men's compound, the very night, I broke out again. This time I went straight for the bus terminal and soon experienced the giddy release of the wheels revolving beneath me as a dark curtain of vegetation lurched past the windows and the striped margins of the road home came clear in the first light of dawn. What I didn't yet appreciate was that after the first abortive attempt at escape, the colonel had issued an alert to all carriers to be on the lookout for any big man seeking passages out of the province. They were waiting for me at the end of the line. Did I go quietly? No, I didn't. When I saw them there in their black Mariah with its chopping blue light, I came down off the bus like a hurricane and laid that vehicle over on its roof till the men it contained came crawling out the windows and I snatched them up two at a time and flung them behind me like so many paper dolls. Sadly, they'd anticipated me here too. And their chloroform canisters brought me down as swiftly and surely as if I were that king ape in the cinema show we'd all marveled at in simpler times when the images played across the screen like waking dreams and Rosa breathed quietly at my side. I awoke in a damp subterranean place that smelled of the raw dirt of the floor and the whitewash slathered over the rough stone of the walls. Here was a huge vault of a room, lit dimly by a pair of gray bulbs and wall sconces. A silent place where no one would hear my cries of outrage or pleas for freedom. I was laid out on my back, on one of the big industrial strength beds, and my hands and ankles were bound up in chains, and not merely run-of-the-mill chains, but the heavy steel links they used to moor boats in the harbor of my ancestral home by the sea. It took me no more than 60 seconds to intuit where I was. That is, in the basement of the three-story brick building where the colonel had his offices overlooking the poor huts and open sewers of the village beyond. If I listened carefully, I could hear the sound of footsteps on the floor above and of a chair rolling back and forth on its casters. I tugged at my chains, of course, but they held me fast, secured not to the posts of the bed, but to the great Sayyiba pillars that rose out of the shadows at the four corners of the room to disappear in the ceiling above. Almost as soon as I opened my eyes, a door swung open at the far end of the room, and a woman entered, bearing a tray of food. She was of average height and weight, this woman, no Amazon. And as I soon discovered, it was her task to spoon-feed me as I lay there under the burden of my chains. "Release me," I whispered, but she shook her head. "Just one hand so I can eat. I feel like an infant lying here. Please, I beg you." She shook her head again and pressed a spoonful of the rich seafood stew we know as zarzuela to my lips. If I'd had any notion of refusing it, of going on a hunger strike, to protest the way I was being treated, mistreated, the scent and taste of that zarzuela drove it away. You can't begin to imagine what it takes to fuel the cells of this body that entraps me. I ate hungrily and gladly. And then the women started coming to me, three a day, morning, afternoon, and evening, the big women, the giantesses, lowering themselves over me as I lay chained and helpless beneath them. Did I want to perform the act? No, but I was devoured by lust, perpetually aroused, no matter that I was rebelling inside or that I found the women gross and the task odious. They must have been putting something in my food, one of the coarse brown powders, easily attainable at any Chinese herbalist shop, the ground horn of the rhinoceros or the friable bones of the tiger infused in alcohol. The women came. I stared at the ceiling. My rage grew. It must have been the third or fourth day when the colonel appeared. He was seated in a wicker chair drawn up to my bed as I awakened one afternoon from a bludgeoning dream, and he began lecturing me without preliminary. "You may be interested to know," he said, "that you have obtained excellent results, superior, the best of your cadre." "Release me," I said, my voice tense and caught deep in my throat. He was studying a notepad. He took a minute to smooth the top sheet with his fingers. "Some 76% of the women you've," he broke off, searching for the right phrase, "been with, have become impregnated. Congratulations. If you release me, I promise, I swear on my mother's soul that I will do my duty without complaint, without..." He held up a hand. "Speaking of your mother, she's doing very well for herself, better than she's ever done in all her life, thanks to the stipend you're providing. She appreciates your service, as does the president." Here he leaned in close to me, and I saw that a small glittering object was dangling by a ribbon from his right hand, a medal such as the military doles out to its heroes. In the next moment, I felt the pressure of his fingers as he pinned it to the breast of my shirt. "You'll be released in good time," he said, "so that you can go back to the compound where you'll be more comfortable. But we all feel that for the present, given your, what shall I say, recalcitrance, not to mention dereliction of duty, you'll be better off here. Really, it's for your own good. And the president's, too. That goes without saying." Later, in my boredom and the solitude that ground me down till my consciousness floated free, "Rosa, Rosa, where are you?" I shifted my neck and forced my head as far back against the pillow as it would go so that I was able to squint down the vast slope of my chest and get a look at the medal the president had devised as a token of his gratitude. Dangling from the ribbon was a figure cast in metal, either gold or brass, I never did discover which. It took me a moment, squinting, as I say, to see what it represented. A bull, rampant, with a thin golden puff of steam spewing from his nostrils. That was it. That was the end. I didn't care what became of me after that. But I knew then that I hadn't been born on this earth to serve anybody, let alone the president, that I didn't love him, didn't even know him, and that the rage building in me, beat by beat, was a force no man could contain, not even a giant. I waited till the mute who served me had left for the remains of the evening meal, and the last giantess had done with me and waddled her way out the door. And then I went deep inside myself, working like a Hindu faker through every cell of my body, from the smallest... my smallest toes to the truncheons of my legs and my torso that was like a bucket of iron, and on up to my shoulders, my biceps and forearms, and down into the reservoirs of my fingers, one digit at a time. Then I began worrying the chain that bound my right arm, thrusting and jerking back again over and over through 1,000 repetitions, till finally it gave way and the arm was free. After that, it was easy. I came up off the bed, chains rattling loose around me, telling tales. And if the guard, who must have been watching through a hidden peephole, came hurtling into the room, I barely noticed. I could have gone through the door and taken the guard with me, but I didn't. No, I just leaned into the nearest pillar and shoved till the whole edifice began to quake and quake again. That was 6 months ago. I wasn't blinded, no one cut my hair, and when the building came down around me, inferior construction, the termites would have gotten it if I hadn't. I found a pocket of air trapped beneath a beam and was spared. I dug my own way out, and if the authorities presumed I was buried beneath the rubble along with the colonel and his functionaries and the great glistening oil portrait of the president, I wasn't about to disabuse them. This time, I avoided public transport, making my way home in the depths of a freight car designed to carry livestock from one place to another. Rosa and I escaped to the high, fractured plains caught fast in the mountains that separate our country from that of our enemies to the south, where we are living now as man and wife in a village populated by Indians whose teeth are eroded by the leaves they chew to give them energy in the high altitudes where they must scrape a poor living from the earth. I earned my own keep here through main strength, as I always have, hauling loads up and down the stony trails that vanish around each bend and drop off thousands of feet to the distant, featureless land below. Am I a beast of burden? Yes, but I'm nobody's beast but my own, and Rosa's. Rosa is pregnant now, incidentally, and if we're lucky, she'll bear our first son come spring, and if we're even luckier, he'll be neither a giant nor a dwarf, but something in between. As for me, I try to keep my head down and avoid attracting notice, but inevitably they'll find me. I know that. How could anybody, let alone a man like me, expect to blend in a land where the people are so very, very small. Thank you. Thank you. Well, thank you for letting me try that out on you. As I say, I'd only read it to my wife and the dog, and the dog was kind of comatose the whole time, so I don't know.
Thank you so much for that wonderful reading.
You're welcome.
Tell us a little bit about the inspiration for that story. What is it that you, what triggered you, your interest in that?
Diseased childhood.
Okay. Less personally than that? Authoritarian regimes?
Yes, of course. You know, taking place in the 30s, it has to do with eugenics and ideas that were meant to transform us as a species. And I'm writing it, of course, in a time in which we have genetic engineering, and that's the next thing around the bend for us. And my plan for dealing with all of this horror is simply to die. I don't know about the rest of you, but that's what I'm going to do.
Hopefully a long time in the future for your readers.
Well, thank you.
And your family.
Thank you. Yeah, I hear the Pope was in town. Will he bless me also?
So you... Is this is a short story that you're planning to publish as a short story?
It was in the New Yorker about a month ago.
Oh, sorry.
And this is the first of a new series of stories. I usually write stories before and after a novel. And so When the Killing's Done, which I'm supposed to be talking about and will at some point, came out last February. It's, again, about the ecology of the Channel Islands across the channel from me. And I then wrote the 6 new stories. You've seen, they were in Harper's and Playboy and in the New Yorker. Death in Kitchewank was one of them. That was like 2 years ago. Then I wrote a new novel, and it's called San Miguel. It comes out in September. And it's also set on the Channel Islands. I discovered an historical story while I was doing this contemporary ecological story. It's just fascinated me. San Miguel, as you may know, is the farthest island out to the north and west of the Channel Islands, off of Point Conception there. It's cold, it's windy, there's no trees. It had been used for sheep ranching. So I took two stories, true historical stories, where women had left diaries. One was from 1888 when Marantha Waters, a San Francisco woman, was persuaded by her second husband to give the money that was left to her by her first husband and go down to San Miguel as a cure for her tuberculosis because of the air is so good. But the air there, it makes San Francisco look like Barbados. I mean, it's freezing and blowing all the time and so on, so she didn't do too well. Then there was this second story that had amazing parallels to it. Again, this is an island owned by one person, and they live in this island like kings and queens. And the second story is 1930 to 1942, the famous Lester family. Again, a similar story. The bride, a very cultured woman of the upper classes from New York, but sort of a homely woman and an awkward woman. And she was now a spinster in her 30s when along came this dashing guy who had a plan. Let's go to San Miguel Island and raise sheep. And how could she resist? So I'm telling that story as well. And I had a lot of fun with it, although I will say that it's an experiment for me in that it's a straightforward historical narrative sans irony and the wise guy stuff that, you know, is so natural to me. I just wanted to see if I could do that. It's told entirely in the voices of three women. And so I finished that, delivered it in July, and I've been writing stories ever since. And these will comprise the last volume of the, as I said earlier, of T.C. Boyle Stories 2 for the following year.
So your San Miguel book and the When the Killing is Done book, both are full of rich detail, rich historical detail, as are your biographical novels and so on. How do you do research? How did you discover the historical story about the Channel Islands? Libraries, internet, what's your process?
All of it, all the above. I really wanted to go out to the Channel Islands. I've been driving by them for all these years. I've lived in Santa Barbara for 19 years. I can see it out the window. I wondered what goes on out there, you know? Now I know. And further, this was spurred by the true story that I'm telling, which was reported in the press over the past decade, the restoration of the island by the removal of invasive species. And so the most outrageous part, of course, and I still have the clipping on my refrigerator door, eagles arrive as pigs are killed. That's the headline from the local paper. It was determined by the Park Service and the Nature Conservancy that to keep the island fox and the other native species from going extinct, invasive species had to be removed. And so, to the tune of $7 million, an agency from New Zealand, which specializes in cleansing islands, came and shot dead 5,500 feral pigs, descendants of pigs that were released there by the initial farmers in 1850. They were left to rot. The ravens were happy about it, by the way, and I'm sure they had a population boom. But this was in terms of the ecologists. And by the way, I was out there many times with the fox lady herself, Rachel Wollstonecroft, trapping these foxes and looking at them and so on. It had to be done in order to keep them from going extinct. And it's a very bizarre story, almost the kind of thing that you would think Samuel Beckett would have come up with. It's so preposterous, but it illustrates what happens when you add or remove a given species from a closed ecosystem. And, of course, the larger lesson is more and more we're finding that island biogeography applies simply to land masses now because they are divided into islands as far as animals are concerned. So that is what spurred it.
So from the audience, we have a clever question. How long does it take for a non-native, exotic, so-called invasive plant or animal to get its green card? Can the grizzly bear ever be repatriated in California?
Yeah, great question. And I'm devoting all my energy and income, and I hope Oprah's listening, to tearing down everything in Montecito and reintroducing the grizzly bear. That's my ambition. This is the essential question of the book. You know, it begins with a quote from Genesis, giving us dominion over all the animals of the sea and the birds, the fowls of the air, and so on. How do we have the right, ethically, to manipulate nature and manipulate the other animals, and what is the result of that? And so, to answer the question, what is your baseline? And so, my animal activist in this, who's a very angry man, but has one essential principle, thou shalt not kill, he asked him, what is your baseline? I mean, you're going to take this island back to 1850? Are you going to take it back to 1750 before human beings were there? I mean, why not go back to Jurassic Park? So, I mean, this is one of the central questions of trying to restore an ecosystem. It's very difficult. By the way, it was a success. Wow, I mean, it would take me a while. I can't tell you the whole story, but it's quite fascinating. In short, in 1940, Montrose Chemical dumped DDT into Santa Monica Bay. It worked its way up the food chain, and it prevented the bald eagles native to these islands from hatching their eggs. They died off. In their absence, golden eagles, which are primarily carnivorous, feeding on land animals, whereas balds are primarily piscivorous, moved in. What attracted them? Well, these delicious little piglets. However, once the sheep were removed from the island, the sheep, of course, eat everything right down to the dirt and were negatively impacting the very ecology of the island. The trees are necessary to capture the mist to give it water, and now there are no more adult trees because anything sprouting will be chewed up. Once the sheep left, the invasive fennel, yes, the fennel that you use in your sausage, again, in 1850, thrown there in the kitchen garden by these guys, is rampant. It's as big as this room. Well, that had been chewed down to nothing by the sheep, but in their absence, now there are these huge thickets, and the delicious piglets were hiding in the thickets. Meanwhile, here are these gorgeous, cute little Disney foxes, 4 pounds, found nowhere else in the world, smaller than your house cat. And they evolved in a place where there are no predators. They don't even look up. And suddenly their numbers were being decimated. They started out with 1,500. By the time biologists found out what was going on, there were fewer than 300, and they had to do captive breeding. Lotus Vermeer, who is head of the Nature Conservancy on this island, showed me on her laptop this picture of a golden eagle chick, proud and beautiful. We love it so much. It's a bit this big with claws like your hands, sitting there proudly. Beneath it are the remains of 20 foxes, one of which is wearing a radio collar, which is how they figured out the problem. Okay, so kill the pigs, catch the golden eagles, not so easy to do, remove them to the Sierras, reintroduce the balds. And my wife and I were there to see the first 2 bald chicks since 1940 released on the island. And this is a few years back, so so far so good. But, I mean, you know, it's a preposterous story, and it really has a great ethical dimension. And that question speaks right to it.
And as to that ethical dimension, you pose the question, how do you decide about this? Who has the right? Which species have the right to exist? Do you have an opinion on this?
Well, yes, of course, but I'm not going to tell you.
Okay.
Because then it ruins it for every reader entering the book. And, again, this book is being compared to a degree to the tortilla curtain, because it's a book about an issue, and yet it's presenting an issue and dramatizing an issue. And it, you know, I think this is what art is supposed to do. It's supposed to allow you to enter it into a new world and make up your own mind. You know, otherwise, give a speech, write an essay.
So, the tortilla curtain. How many years ago was that published?
95.
So.
Oh, and by the way, let me just interrupt for 1 second. I had the great pleasure on the tour for that book. It's about illegal immigration in Southern California, and it aroused a lot of ire in its time and still does. The great pleasure right here in this city on a live radio show with call-ins of being called human garbage by a caller. I thanked her for the compliment, of course. But I'm sorry.
So, go ahead, Gloria. Actually, I encountered the book when it was chosen as Silicon Valley Reads annual book to read, probably 5, 6, 7 years ago. That's San Jose and Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I was there.
Valley.
I came up for that, yes.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Maybe even spoke at the Commonwealth Club.
I did indeed.
But since you published the book, in the debate and consciousness about immigration, has anything changed? Do you think that we've evolved at all in understanding the problem?
Yes, I think we have on the coasts. I think, as you can see from the Republican Party, that perhaps it still remains quite a great issue elsewhere. You know, the book is still very relevant, and I suppose that's kind of sad.
Someone in the audience said they heard the tortilla curtain was optioned for a film. Why was it never made? Is it true that it was optioned for a film?
I'm a lucky man. Many, many things are optioned for film. The options are eternal. I'm also very wise in that even though I lived in L.A. all those years and live close to it now, I have never considered participating in any film project in any way whatsoever and never will, because it's a kind of eternal torture. And I don't want to do that. I want to have my own life and write my own stories and do my own thing and make art. So I have stayed away. Yes, there have been several deals. In fact, there's a new one, actually. I don't pay that much attention, but I do get some information. Yeah, they were constantly, the old deal that went on for years, they were constantly announcing inappropriate actors like Kevin Costner is going to play Delaney and so on and so on. And Eva Mendes is going to play America and so on. All right, fine, you know. But nothing ever came of it. So recently, someone else optioned, and I'm sorry I don't know their names because I don't pay attention, but they are producers who made Children of Men, which was, you know, was a pretty good movie, and hallelujah, maybe they'll make a good movie. I don't really participate. I don't know. I love movies, and I hope for the best.
I want to remind the audience there is a mic here, so please feel free to ask your questions verbally as well as sending me any questions that you might have in writing. And for our radio and internet audience, this is the Commonwealth Club radio broadcast with the author T.C. Boyle.
If we have enough time, I would like to reread Los Gigantes in Polish.
Okay. Is that okay? There you go.
No?
So you have written novels based on the lives of John Harvey Kellogg, Frank Lloyd Wright, Alfred Kinsey, Stanley McCormick. Many of those individuals were brilliant creative talents, also narcissistic and maybe even a little bit sociopathic. Why are you attracted to these characters? Do you think these qualities, this package of qualities, is often related, that the brilliance derives from the narcissism?
Yeah, I like to call them, and I joke with my editor, we can do a box set, the great egomaniacs of the 20th century. Yes. You people don't know me that well, but I am perfect, and I am a saint. But I know many novelists who are not, and they tend to have the same kind of grandiose feelings about themselves and their work as these men felt about themselves and their work. Kinsey, Kellogg, and Wright all did amazing things and transformed our societies in ways that are eternal. It's just great. But each of them only viewed everybody else as a cog in their machine. They had no interest in you unless you were a follower or a devotee, and they were the guru. And I just wonder about that, what that relationship is. Each one of them seemed to suggest the next for me, and I don't think I'll write about such figures again, but I never know. In fact, I don't know what the next novel will be yet. Again, I'm deeply into these stories, but if the summer goes by and I don't have a new novel going, you'll read about my suicide in the papers.
You are incredibly prolific. Do you ever take a year off or months off?
No.
Not right?
No, I don't feel good unless I'm working on something. It's a kind of obsessive-compulsive behavior. You may know on tcboyle.com my essay about this monkey, my back, in which I'm comparing the creation of art, especially when you see it come together, to a kind of drug high. But like a drug addiction, then you need to do it again and again and again. And I think that's great for me, and I hope great for an audience for art, for any kind of art, you know. But it's just a way of that I have of viewing the world, and I just don't feel comfortable as I'm working on something. And I feel best when I'm in the middle. Well, not the middle, no. Right? The middle is the hardest part. When I am eagerly working on something and I can see the end in sight, that's when all of the threads come together and you understand why you're doing it and so on. You've only just heard this one story tonight, a recent story. I don't know what it will be. I have no idea what it is. It just starts, and I follow it day by day and see where it's going, and eventually I find out.
A lot of your stories and books are set deeply in the natural world, the most recent, obviously, the most intensely. What's your own relationship to the natural world? Do you walk, hike, garden? What's your involvement with nature? You have a dog. We heard that.
Formerly. She's no longer with us. Like these egomaniacs from whom I like to distinguish myself, I'm extremely competitive. And all my competition is focused now on one thing, writing, and the vigorous walking in the woods while muttering to myself, formerly with the dog. That's it. So I spend a lot of time in nature. In finishing San Miguel, I spent off and on 6 months up in the Sequoia National Forest, where I have a little hideaway. And it's just great because I get away from real life and I work longer and harder because it's so boring. And I read more because it's so boring. But I also am embracing nature. I just love to be alone in the wilderness, especially in a wild place. I've had 3 encounters with the mountain lion up there, all very exciting.
And you didn't shoot it like the head of our Fish and Game Commission proudly did in Idaho recently.
God should be ashamed of himself. But now he's proud of himself. And again, he says he violated no law. It's legal there. But of course, we have twice told our legislators how we feel about it. And to have this man as one, in a position of authority who's supposed to be protecting our natural resources is a little bit of questionable judgment.
One of those murky ethical areas that you like to get into.
Yeah.
Didn't literally do anything wrong, but something common sense tells you it doesn't set a good example.
Yeah, I'm very happy to know that there are creatures besides us still alive. And I feel bad for the people in the world, now 7 billion of us, who have no opportunity to be in nature or observe nature or know anything about it or know what it's like to be by yourself in a remote place. To me, it's a great part of my life and a thrilling thing.
You had an early venture into music.
Yes. Yes, I went to SUNY Potsdam. That's our music school in New York. I played the saxophone. I was a devotee of John Coltrane, and I wanted to be a musician, but I found that I couldn't hack it. I wasn't nearly as gifted as some of the others. Renee Fleming, by the way, is a graduate of Potsdam. And I really hadn't much of a feel for the kind of music that we were playing. Later, you know, I graduated to howling my guts out in a rock and roll band, and that was fine. And I listen to music all day long, every day. I love music, but I don't play music anymore because it requires full time and full concentration and lots of rehearsal and total devotion. And I'm devoted to something else now, which, by the way, is not my art. It's cleaning up after my wife.
I think all good husbands do that.
Yeah, well, I don't know any other model, you know.
And you teach at USC.
Yes.
What do you think of your current students? I mean, the conventional wisdom is that writing is becoming infected by the Internet and communication at the level of Twitter feeds and that the type of rich, evolved writing that you do is rare. Do you find that in your students? Do you find a wonderful crop of new writers coming along?
The answer to the first question is no. The answer to the second question is yes. And you may be right. I mean, the society at large, another reason why I love to get away in nature, is we don't have any time to focus or contemplate things because we're all so busy all the time. Because of these machines that controls. You saw the Terminator, which our former governor starred in. Well, guess what, folks? We're living in it right now. The machines completely control us in every possible way, and I resent that. So, yeah, I think you're right. It's a society that has an attention span this far, and it's terrible. However, if you're an artist participating in art, whether you're a painter or a musician or a writer, you have a gift for it and a passion for it, and I've always found that with my students. Now, I've been at USC for 34 years. And by the way, you see how young I am. I was like Jesus in the temple. I was 9 when I started. USC was not a very good school at that time. Now it is great. It's really become quite superb. But students have always been great because they're artists and they're participating in an art. And so, yeah, they blow me away. That's what keeps me going. They are just amazing.
Do you have former students out there that you're proud of?
Oh, yeah. Many, many, many. Thea Olbrett had a great success with her first book, The Tiger's Wife, last year. Mm-hmm. Jason Reitman had a little help, but he's made some pretty good movies. He's one of mine. Sandra Singh Lo, the performance mm-hmm. artist. There are many, many. And incidentally, the other day, a student from the early 80s came in to visit, and I knew him as a sleek and handsome young man. Well, now he's a decrepit old man, and he's put on weight, and his daughter is going to college.
Another generation coming along.
Absolutely.
So Do you have three children? What does each of them do? One is still a student. You have a daughter who is...
My daughter, Carrie Gvashe Boyle, is a writer. She's published stuff, and she and her boyfriend, Jameson Fry, are filmmakers. They are up. They just left today, as I left for here. They left today for Vancouver, where they're making a film for Warner Brothers, but on the Internet. I'm not quite sure what it is. But they're filming this thing, and it's a real deal, and so on and so on. Vancouver, by the way, cheaper there than the film in L.A., I guess. So they're doing great, and they live really far away from me, next door. And my son Milo, the genius who invented my webpage in 1999 when he was a kid in high school and wrote the program and invented it, so that I'm one of the oldest bloggers on the Internet, even though I never even heard the term blog until 3 years ago. He lives in Manhattan on the Upper East Side because his girlfriend wants him to. And my son, Spencer, is at USC now finishing up his degree in screenwriting. Mm-hmm. They all like movies. Mm-hmm. And so do I. And I have many friends in the business and actors and directors and so on. I'll help them all I can. It's okay.
So again, yes, go to the mic if you would.
I'm interested in ecological issues, and I'm very opinionated. It seems like you might have opinions of your own. And I'm wondering if you can comment on how to develop the richness of the characters that you don't like so much, because that's needed in a novel.
Mm, well, thank you. I think you're referring to Dave LaJoy, the antagonist in this novel, who is one of these guys who's just angry all the time. He's angry at everything. He's got too much testosterone. He's over the top. He is odious in many, many ways. And yet, as I said earlier, you can't really argue with his passion for the animals. I try to make it a challenge as a novelist to inhabit anybody of any sexual orientation, ethnicity. It's just a challenge to enter somebody. Again, as I say, the San Miguel is written entirely in the point of view of three women. I just want to see if I can do it, because otherwise you write the same thing over and over again. So I can't really answer the question exactly, except that I get under a spell of what's happening and just try to be that person. And so what if, you know, I have to come home and beat my wife in the guise of Dave LaJoy? I do clean the house constantly, you know?
So do you have, in some ways, many of the central figures in your novels could qualify. They're not especially likable people, or they're successful, but they're a little wacky or off. Do you have a list of such characters that you keep, that you think you might like to write about?
No. They're all invented on the spot. Although, yes, there aren't a whole lot of likable characters, and always terrible, terrible things, wrenching, horrible things happen to them because, of course, I am the god of their universe. one of my closest friends is Pablo Campos, the painter who lives in L.A. And I said, Pablo, you know, this is a real problem. I think I'm going to write a novel about a novelist and his friend, the painter, and they are very, very happy and very, very healthy and very, very rich. What do you think?
I think of the anti-hero in the novel Talk Talk, who is the identity thief.
Yeah, William Peck Wilson.
One of the most odious characters in literature.
Well, thank you so much. Oh, and you know, that's a great compliment.
Who preys on...
I had the greatest compliment of my entire career about a week ago. I was walking across campus and I ran into a colleague of mine who is an editor of an online magazine about narrative theory. And she said that she recently had a poll of all the readers of this of the most depressing story ever written. And my story, Chicxulub, won. The second most depressing novel was Jude the Obscure. But mine won as the most depressing story of all time.
Creating those emotions, whatever they are, you're a master at it.
Well, thank you so much.
We unfortunately are at the end of our program. Thank you so much for that wonderful reading of Los Gigantes.
You're welcome.
And for sharing some thoughts about your writer's craft with us. So our appreciation to T.C. Boyle, the novelist, and to you all for being here with us this evening. Thank you.
Thanks, Laura.
And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.